treatment in Romans chapter 1 of the manifestation of the wrath of God toward the unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. In Romans 1:18, we saw this verse last time, but there is much in it to consider. He says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. But in fact, let me read the whole section again. I hope you'll bear with me, because people listening to the tape might listen to it sometime a long time after listening to the previous tape. I want this whole passage to be before us as we look at it. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one for another, men with men, committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, but God gave them over to a debased mind, or a reprobate mind, another translation, correct translation, to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. Now, it's a long passage, but so important that we see the whole thing at one time, even though we're minutely looking at individual verses and words and phrases. As we go through, it's the context of this whole chapter that is so important for us to understand what Paul is saying. Because he says that in verse 17, he says that in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. And in verse 18, he says the wrath of God is revealed. But when he says the righteousness of God is revealed, he states very plainly where we see the righteousness of God, in the gospel. When he says the wrath of God is revealed, it's not quite as clear what he means. Where is that revealed? I mean, revealed means it's been made visible. The veil's been pulled away so all can see it. He is acting as if the wrath of God is visible to all. We can just look and see the wrath of God revealed from heaven against all these ungodly people. Well, I look around and do I see the wrath of God revealed? What is it? What form is it that I expect to see the wrath of God take? I think of the flood in Noah's day where God wiped out the whole population except for a small remnant. I think of Sodom and Gomorrah, where God sent fire and brimstone from heaven and wiped them out. Or I think of God's wrath upon Jerusalem when he sent the Babylonians or later the Romans and just annihilated the city, wiped out the people and took them into slavery. That's the wrath of God revealed. But in Paul's day, none of those things were happening. There was no fire from heaven coming down. There was no flood wiping out the race. There wasn't even any war going on. In our day, do we see the wrath of God revealed from heaven? And if so, where? Where is this manifestation? Where was it when Paul wrote? He indicated that it's visible. It's revealed. And I believe that as we read the rest of the chapter, we see in exactly what way it is revealed. But it's subtle. Futile has the aisle sound. Subtle doesn't. It is subtle, and we have to be told where to look. And Paul tells us where to look. He says, it's revealed, but I'll show you where it is. It is here. Verse 24. Therefore God gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. It is here, verse 26. For this reason God gave them up to vile passions. And in verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind. Now what is this talking about? God gave them up. God gave them over. What did he give them over to? What they wanted. They wanted to live in their lusts, so he gave them up to live in their lusts. And to live with the consequences of it. Which consequences are not described here as hell, although we do believe that hell is a consequence ultimately. He doesn't even describe the consequences of it as being, you know, they get venereal disease, although some people think there might be a reference to that at the end of verse 27. The consequences that he finds as a manifestation of the wrath of God against these people is that they get more and more depraved. They are left to their own devices, and their sin is allowed to grow in them until they are beyond redemption. Now, realize this. The Bible teaches that when a person is born, that person is born with they're born with an urge towards self-centered self-gratification, which we call sin. And sin is that which, if followed, will damn a person. So we could argue that a child who is born on the road to hell. And if they do not get off of that road, they will end up in hell. Because they are born with a beginning with an urge to please themselves, not God, to sin. And as they act upon that urge, they establish patterns of sin that become more and more ingrained. And if you see an old sinner, you see a scary thing. You see a young sinner, and you can almost picture that person getting saved, even if they're quite sinful. You can almost say, I could see that guy getting saved someday. Yeah, he's just kind of blind. He's just a youthful fool. And, you know, someday he might just see the light. But as you see a person getting to be 50, 60, 70 years old, 80 years old, and they've rejected light, and they've suppressed truth, and they have said no to God again and again and again, you get more and more the impression this person is kind of beyond redemption. In fact, even if you didn't have that as a prejudice about them, just seeing that they've lived a long time rejecting God, you could see it by their behavior. And by the way, their anger and their hatred toward God in many cases. Haven't you heard those stories I have of people who escaped, you know, flaming airline disasters? And they got out alive, but few did. And they said, you know, the one thing I noticed around me is all the people were cursing God as they were, you know, their clothes were on fire and they're dying. And I got out, but all the people around me, I heard them cursing God and swearing and blaspheming. I think, man, what a way to go down. You know, I mean, your last words, blasphemies against God, how could anyone be such a fool? I mean, even if I lived as a blasphemer, if my clothes were on fire and I thought I was going to die in a plane crash, I might start talking different, you know? Because I'm about ready to meet God. And yet, it never crosses their mind, apparently. They've established themselves in hatred of God and rejection of truth. Their hearts are no longer capable of making a sensible, reasoned decision about God anymore. They have become slaves of their own sinful decisions. And they are, in many cases, beyond redemption. I'm not saying if you meet a person who's 80 years old and still not saved, that they can't be saved. I have heard of people that age and older getting saved. I heard the testimony of a remarkable man. I think his name was Jim Sullivan. He was the driver, when he was a young man, he was a driver for Bonnie and Clyde. He was in a life of crime, and his association with Bonnie and Clyde was only a small part of his life of crime. He was also a gangster, and he was also a bank robber, and he also killed a lot of people. He killed his own wife, who was committing adultery with a policeman. He killed the policeman, too. He had a real horrible life. And in his late in life, when he was in his 70s, he was a casino owner in Las Vegas, and he was, you know, with the mob and everything. And to make a long story short, he got saved. And when I heard him give his testimony, he was just a humble, soft-hearted, childlike man. When he talked about the grace of God, he wept and he got choked up. I think, man, a guy in his 70s actually got saved after a life of crime and sin. And I'm not going to minimize what God can do. But I will say this, there have been statistical studies done that show the percentage of people or the percentage of likelihood of someone getting saved after certain ages. Judging from the demographics of people who get converted. That like the chance of someone getting saved when they're, you know, under 20 or something like that is pretty high. You know, if they're exposed to the gospel, the chances are 40-50% that they'll get saved. And as you get the age higher, the percentage gets down lower. And you get up around 70, around age 70. And the chances of a person being converted, even by being exposed to the gospel, is way down, like, you know, 2% or something like that, really low. Illustrating the fact that although you do have remarkable exceptions and remarkable trophies of God's grace, of even saving people, grasping them just from the pit of hell on the edge of the end of their life, yet for the most part, the older a person gets and the longer they reject God, the more established and hardened in their heart they get and the more incapable of repentance. The more they move toward that final stage of having a reprobate mind. The word reprobate, scholars tell us the word reprobate means a mind incapable of making moral judgments. A mind that no longer has a conscience about right and wrong. If you numb your conscience by suppressing what you know is true and not obeying the conscience, you can numb it. It can become callous. You can sear the conscience, according to Paul, who's writing to Timothy. People have their conscience seared. That means cauterized, as with a hot iron. And the rejection of truth, you know, a lot of people say, well, I'll live it up and I'll have my fun and I'll reject the gospel. But on my deathbed, when I know I'm really going to have to go face God, then I'll repent. Don't count on it. It's not a given that you can. You might want to and not be able to. I read some years ago of an interesting study that was done of patients who had been given up for dead by their doctors, and they'd been declared, within their last weeks of life, and they were given a certain period that they're going to die in that time, and that was it. And they called the people who were the subjects of the study had made an effort to get right with God on their deathbed, and they had called for the priest or they'd called for the preacher, and they'd said a sinner's prayer, and they'd done what they could do to get right with God because they were convinced they were going to die and they wanted to get right with God. The study was done on people of that class who had in fact recovered unexpectedly and hadn't died. They had been on their deathbed, as they thought, and they had repented as best they could because they really planned to go and meet God. But when they recovered, a very, very small percentage of them actually lived for God. Very few. Which, of course, simply demonstrates that although they tried to repent, there was no genuine repentance. And the fact that they tried to repent at a time when they thought they were surely dying means that they tried as hard as they could to repent. They wanted to get right with God. But they were apparently unable to do so. They could say the words, they could say the sinner's prayer, but their heart was unchanged. They were not converted. Which is demonstrated by the fact of their unexpected reversal of the circumstances, and they lived on and didn't live for God. No doubt had they died, all would have rejoiced. Ah, he gave his life to the Lord just in time. He went to heaven. But in fact, in many cases, we have reason to believe they would not have gone to heaven. Because if you wait long enough, if you put God off and you say, here's the truth, but I don't want the truth right now, maybe later, that later may never come. Even if you have advance warning that you're going to die, your heart may be beyond the point where it can truly repent. It may be hardened. You cannot reject what you know to be truth. You cannot turn from light continuously without your heart by stages getting harder, harder, number, number, seared, 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 totally incapable of having feeling toward God. And at the time when you know in your mind it's time to get right with God, your heart may not be capable any longer. of really feeling the sense of your guilt of your sin and really surrendering to God with, you know, from the deepest point of the heart. The heart is gone. The mind is reprobate. And the wrath of God is seen not so much in Him sending fire and brimstone down on the wicked, but on letting them go. You see, if a child is born on the road to hell, the most merciful thing God can do is to intervene, to put up roadblocks, to make their sinful life uncomfortable, to, you know, expose them to the gospel, to convict them of their sin, to do everything He can to persuade them to leave the path of destruction that they're on. That's the mercy of God. They don't like it at the time, it may be. I mean, God, get out of my life. Get out, you know, just leave me alone. Let me do what I want to do. They may not view it as the mercy of God that He keeps making them feel so bad in their life about their life of sin, but that is the mercy of God. Because if He does not succeed in turning them from that path, they will die and be punished in eternity. And it is God's mercy that He intervenes. When God finally says, okay, I will leave you alone. Go ahead. Sin all you want. I won't bother your conscience about it at all. And He gives them up. That is the wrath of God. That is the most hopeless situation God could leave them to. Is that He doesn't try any longer to change them. And He just says, go for it. You want it? You chose it? I'll even help you along. I'll send you a strong delusion. You want lies? I'll give you a lie. I'll send you a man of sin. I'll send you a strong delusion that you'll believe the lie because you did not receive the love of the truth. This is the wrath of God. You might say, I don't see the wrath of God manifest. You do. You just don't know where to recognize it. When you see the person whose heart is getting harder and harder and seems to be given over, they can sin without pangs of conscience. And God seems to have let them go in their sin. He's not bothering them about it anymore. That's the wrath of God against ungodliness of men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. Now, this is actually something that goes by stages, and I want to make some observations here because there's some specific things in the passage that are worthy of note. First of all, he says in verse 19 about those who have suppressed the truth. Verse 19 says, because what may be known of God is manifest in them. Or the word in can mean among them. It doesn't mean that they've had an inward revelation necessarily. It may just mean that in their society, where they live, among them, there are ample evidences about God that they are choosing to ignore. It's not as if the evidence that God exists is in some other country. They have to cross the ocean to get somewhere to hear the gospel. Right there among them, right where they are, the evidences of who God is are there. What may be known of God is manifest among them. For God has shown it to them. Now, where has He shown it to them? Well, more than one way, but the point that Paul makes in verse 20 is that the creation, for example. I mean, no one can claim they haven't seen that unless they're literally blind. But the creation, from the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen. There's a paradox. How could something that's invisible be clearly seen? But His invisible attributes are seen, are made visible. Where? In the creation, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead. The word Godhead is obviously a strange word. We don't use it very much, except maybe in religious circles. But Godhead literally means deity, or divine nature, or the fact of being God, as opposed to not being God. His Godhead, the Greek word means His deity, or His divine nature. Now, not everything about God can be seen in nature. Some things can. Enough can to make a person responsible for not being an atheist. Obviously, you can't look at nature without any exposure to the gospel and deduce the facts of the gospel. A person who's never heard the gospel couldn't look at the grass grow and the birds sing and the stars in the sky and deduce, wow, God sent His Son to die on the cross for my sins and rose again the third day. Man. I mean, that's not what is evident in nature. And Paul doesn't claim that that is. What's interesting, though, is that Paul claims that what little about God can be known from nature is enough to make them, as he puts it, without excuse. In other words, if a person is without excuse, it means that what they are doing, they didn't have to do. There was another option open to them. If a person is predestined by God before they're born to be an unbeliever, then I dare say they have an excuse. They have an excuse for being an unbeliever. God made them that way and wanted them that way and determined that they'd be that way. But Paul says people are without excuse, which means they had an option. An excuse, if it is a valid excuse, and certainly he's saying they have no valid excuse. Certainly people have excuses. They make them all the time. But they have no valid excuse. For an excuse to be valid, it means that I had no choice. If I did the wrong thing, the only valid excuse is I was forced to do it by my circumstance. There was no option open to me. Therefore, the only thing I could do is this wrong thing. Because if I had some other thing I could do, I couldn't make any excuse for doing the wrong. If there were two options open to me, I chose the wrong one, I have no excuse. But if there's only one option open and I did what was inevitable, that's a pretty good excuse, I'd say you have. So the very fact that Paul says they are without valid excuse means that they had an option and they made the wrong choice. Now the choice they made was to suppress the truth in their unrighteousness and to invite thereby the wrath of God upon themselves. That's the choice they made. But they had no excuse because there was another choice they could have made, which they did not. Obviously, they could have done something different with the light they had and had a different result in terms of God's feelings toward them. They could have escaped the wrath of God upon them. They could have escaped this blindness. But what did they have? They had only the knowledge of His eternal power and deity. They could see that in nature. You might not be able to learn anything about the history of Jesus Christ from nature, but one thing you could do if you're open-minded is you can look at nature, human nature as well, even your own heart and conscience. And you'd have to conclude a couple of things if you're reasonable, unless you're suppressing the obvious, which many people prefer to do. And that is, you'd conclude there's got to be a God. Now, I hate to be so rudimentary and primitive in my thinking, because what I'm about to say is viewed by evolutionists as hopelessly naive and outdated thinking. But in my opinion, an intelligent, plain man without an agenda would conclude that where there is design, there was a designer. Now, this is not a new or fancy apologetic argument. This goes back as far as Christian apologetics goes. It goes back to Paul. And before, it goes back to David. In Psalm 19, he said, "The heavens declare the glory of God." And, his handiwork and light and truth and words and their message speaks to all nations. He's talking about God's reality is manifest in nature. And how so? Well, it's quite obvious. We are accustomed at the human level with inventions. Whether we're a primitive tribe that has invented nothing but more complicated than a wheel and a lever, or whether we live in a highly sophisticated society that we've got computers and machines and spacecraft and all kinds of things like that. But we know that when we see an invention, there was an inventor. We can tell the difference between something that is formed without design and something that is formed by design. And this, you don't need a computer for your analogy. You can go to the most primitive forms of design. If you found in a river a round pebble, and in the same river an Indian arrowhead carved from a stone, from flint, you would know instantly that one of those things came into being by design, by human design, and the other did not. It's the most primitive form of sculpture, perhaps, that man has ever done, but you can see instantly and without mistake, this has had the hand of a designer on it. This has been shaped by a tool. This was made for a purpose. This round stone, that was just shaped by the forces of nature. There's no evidence that human design had anything to do with this. Man is not incapable of recognizing design where he's willing to see it. I had an atheist call me on the radio once a few years ago, and And we were talking about, you know, the existence of God. And of course, I brought up the old argument, knowing very well it's an old one. I'm not trying to be innovative here. I said, well, there's design in the universe. He said, what design? I don't see any design. I said, well, then I don't think we can talk, because you're not an honest man. If you could tell the design in an arrowhead, then you can see the design in a human brain, which is the most organized piece of matter known to man in the universe, far more complex than any computer. I mean, if you could tell an arrowhead is designed by man and a pebble isn't, then you should be able to tell that a computer or something far more complex and highly designed and more perfectly designed than a computer, it had a designer too. If you're not willing to say that, I'm afraid you're not honest enough for us to continue this conversation. Don't tell me you don't see any design. Now what they're doing, see, the evolutionists have tried very hard to empty the testimony of creation of any testimony for the existence of God. And even before Darwin's time, there were plenty of evolutionists. Darwin's grandfather was an evolutionist before Darwin was. There were a lot of evolutionists. Hindus have believed in evolution from time immemorial, ancient times. Evolution was not an idea that Darwin came up with. It's just an idea that never really stuck among thinking people, and never really became dominant among thinking people, because it didn't make sense. And what Darwin did was present evolution in a way that seemed to make scientific sense. He presented something called the theory of natural selection, where he said, you know, nature itself is capable of causing this progression and development. You know, you're probably familiar with Darwin's ideas. Darwin taught that in nature itself, now he believed in God. He was more like a deist. He believed that God made the first living thing. He said so in the closing paragraph of his book, The Origin of Species. He mentioned that a creator made the first living thing. But he believed that God, who made the first living thing, was not involved after that, and that the forces of nature created by God and set in motion by God were like, you know, like the deist believed the universe like a clock, that God wound it up and left it to run. And that nature is that way. Nature just kind of, natural forces played upon this first living thing, and it reproduced itself and then kept reproducing itself. And it's the nature of things that reproduce to not reproduce exact replicas of themselves, generally speaking. I mean, if your cat has kittens, those kittens may or may not look very much like your cat. They may have markings that are different. They may be different size when they're adults. I mean, there are differences. And Darwin believed that in every generation of species, of specimens, there are some specimens, because of the differences among them, some have differences that fit them better for survival in the struggle for food and the competition for survival. And that, the runt of the litter is not going to make it as well as the one that happened to be gifted by genetics with a bigger, stronger body. And likewise, in a species where creatures are various colors, the ones that have been gifted by genetics with colors that are more suited to camouflage, they're going to do better in the struggle for survival than those have other colorations that don't give them that advantage. And so that basically what he's saying is that in every generation there's going to be some specimens that are by nature alone fitted for ongoing survival, and others are going to be selected out by nature, natural selection. They're selected to be eliminated because they don't have these advantages. And that over the long haul, those advantages will be perpetuated by generation after generation, and eventually these advantages will accumulate. They might be minuscule for thousands of years, undetectable, or millions of years, but eventually the total accumulation of these advantages, some of them at the genetic level and not even appearing in the gross anatomy of the animal, these advantages will accumulate and eventually bring forth a totally new species through the accumulation of millions of these advantages. Now, this is, of course, absolute nonsense. And even many, many of the best scientists in the world will acknowledge it's nonsense. Even some who are not creationists will acknowledge it's nonsense. It simply makes no sense at all based on what we know about the laws of nature. But in Darwin's day, it was a very scientifically naive period of time and eager philosophically to find a way to get God out of his universe. And although Darwin did not himself eliminate God, his followers found in his theories an occasion to eliminate God. Hey, well, if nature can do all this, excellent. You know, we've always kind of wanted to believe that there was no God who designed it, but we've never been able to explain how the appearance of design in nature could exist without a designer. And this explains it. Nature is itself somewhat intelligent. Nature itself eliminates those things that don't make sense. And so the only thing that survives makes sense. And is well designed, is well fitted for environment. And therefore it gives the appearance of being really designed by a designer. But in fact, it's just nature has made the selection, has eliminated those things that didn't fit well. And the things that came out, as it were, a good design, in terms of functionally in nature, have survived. And therefore the appearance of design exists. But there's been no designer. And there are still some evolutionists who believe this. Now, evolution has gone through many changes since the time of Darwin. And there's no evolutionist today believes exactly what Darwin did, because he didn't understand genetics, and all modern evolutionists understand genetics better than he did, and therefore they modified some of his views on some points. But there are some of the leading evolutionists in the world today have rejected Darwin's whole concept of gradual development altogether, and a more popular view among some of the leaders in the field is called punctuated equilibrium, where they believe there is a more of a rapid, jerky kind of, not a smooth, gradual transition into these forms, but it was more of a jerky, disjointed kind of a progress made in you know, fits and jumps and so forth to different species. But still, the unsaved world received from Darwin a tool. And that tool gave them what they thought was an excuse to not believe in God. They could now talk about nature without the troubling notion in the back of their mind that there might be a God who made nature. And what Darwin did was make what they judged to be a plausible explanation for a thinking scientific age of how evolution could happen. He wasn't the first evolutionist, but he was the first to publish it, what looked like a plausible explanation that thinking men could accept and say, yes, that I will accept the sensibleness of this proposition. But still, you know, God will not be mocked. And the wisdom of man is foolishness to God. And even that theory of evolution, which has predominated in the educational realm in the Western world for 130 years or more, has been falling apart. So that even people within its own ranks, even people who are not creationists, in other words, who don't have an axe to grind against the whole concept of evolution, many of them are coming out saying it doesn't work, it doesn't make sense, it's impossible. A recent book by a guy named Michael Behe, a Roman Catholic, but not opposed to evolution, because Roman Catholics can believe in evolution. Microbiologist, I believe, or something like that, molecular biologist. He wrote a book a year or two ago called Darwin's Black Box, which has shaken up the scientific world, because he's talking about the utter complexity of the simplest components of a cell, and saying this is... he says once you get down to looking at the cellular level, you come to a point of what he called irreducible complexity. You know, it used to be thought that complexity arose out of really, really simple starts. You know, a few simple things, real easy to come about naturally by accident would happen, and then the accumulation of more simple kinds of things. He says, no, the proteins that make up the cell and the amino acids that make up the proteins, each of these things, each of these components are incredibly complex. More complex than many of our complex machines. I mean, a protein molecule is more complex than a modern robot in its functioning. People didn't know that in Darwin's day. In fact, people didn't even know that 50 years ago, but they know it now. And Michael Behe is saying, we're going to have to start dealing with this phenomenon here. He was not a creationist in the sense that we think of an evangelical, you know, Bible-thumping fundamentalist. He was a Catholic and an evolutionist scientist. He was in the evolutionary community. And he wrote this book saying, we've got to deal with this phenomenon of irreducible complexity. You get down to the simplest things you need for life, and they're incredibly complex. You can't arrive at them by simple steps. They have to be complete or they don't work. And you have to have it all at once. And while he's not jumping into, you know, therefore we must believe in the biblical view of creation, that's not the position he's taking. He is saying we have to re-look at this idea of whether there's design. And if design, a designer. You've got a guy named Michael Denton, medical doctor and molecular biologist in Australia, who wrote years ago a book called Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. The man's an agnostic. He's not a Christian. And he wrote a devastating critique from a scientific viewpoint, as a man in command of all the most significant evidences. Wonderful book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis by Michael Denton. He's most significant because he's not a creationist writing this. And the voices of criticism against evolution are arising within the atheist, agnostic, scientist community. So that it's not just that, you know, evolution is going to topple because America is getting more religious. Evolution is crumbling under its own weight because in Darwin's day was a naive scientific age, and the simple suggestions Darwin made seemed scientifically plausible. But as science progresses, think it doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. Darwin's views cannot be true. And there's a desperation seen in the evolutionary community right now. They're desperately trying to rework things to fit them into what we now know scientifically, and it doesn't work. And yet they're not willing to give up the faith of evolution and acknowledge there's a designer, but God is not mocked. You know, it's crumbling, and it's going to fall. And eventually it's going to be just, for every one of them, the same way that it was when Paul wrote this, the God's eternal deity and his power is seen in the creation, and they're without excuse. They're without excuse anyway, because evolution never did make more sense than creation. It's just that it for a while was taught as if it were somehow some scientific fact, which it never ever was. Now, Paul indicates that people could deduce from nature, just from thinking, rationally. They don't even have to have any revelations from the scriptures or from prophets or from direct intervention of God. They can just look at nature and they can know there's got to be a God. And whoever he is, he's a big God. He's got eternal power. I mean, to make these stars and this sun and this solar system come into existence by his will, he's got to have seemingly limitless power. Now, that's what Paul says. That's the invisible attributes of God that are seen in his creation, his eternal power and his godhood, his deity. Now, knowing only that about God and knowing nothing more, there's a God. He's a powerful God. He's a big God. Is a start for a pagan. For a person who's never heard the gospel, that's a start. It's enough to make him excuseless, because once he knows this, or at least once he has enough information to so that he should know this, he now has no excuse for atheism. He has no excuse for denying that there's a God. Now, once he comes to the point of acknowledging that there's a God, or even that there might be, you see, an agnostic today does not deny that there's a God. An atheist does. But an agnostic just says, I don't know, there might not, I just don't know if there's a God. That's what true agnosticism says. Well, only an atheist would affirm there is no God, and it's quite a bold assertion to make since it assumes that you know everything there is to know. I mean, to say, I've searched the whole universe, I've looked at every molecule, I know everything there is to know, every realm there is, the visible and the invisible, I'm total master of all that, and I've discovered there's no God there. I mean, that's what atheism innately claims, although most atheists would not like to hear it put that way, but to say there is no God must mean that everywhere in the universe that God might be, I've checked, he's not there. When the Russian cosmonauts were sent up into space the first time, the teachers in the Russian communist schools boasted to their school children, our courageous cosmonauts have gone up into outer space and they didn't see God. I understand one little girl in the classroom raised her hand and said, were they pure in heart? Jesus said the pure in heart will see God. But what a ridiculous thing it is to say, I've been up in space and I haven't seen God anywhere. Well, are there any parts of space you haven't seen? Is there any realm even close at hand that you are not a master of? Is there any possibility of God existing in one of those tiny little areas that you don't know something about? And therefore, once a person ceases to be an atheist, and no thinking person can be one, no thinking person can be an atheist. A thinking person could be an agnostic and say, well, I'm not sure. It looks like there might be a God, but I just am not sure. Okay? I don't know. Agnosticism means I don't know. Frankly, I think even an agnostic is not going all the way with the evidence. I think he's not being totally honest. but he's less dishonest than an atheist. And once a person has discovered there might be a God or there is a God, it is incumbent on them not to ignore that fact. I mean, think about it. If you knew nothing about the gospel, knew nothing about Christ, about God, about the Bible, but you were some savage in a jungle and you reach an age where you're able to contemplate things, you're 9, 10 years old, maybe eight years old, and you're out there looking at the way that our plants that we eat grow from a little tiny seed, and babies come from seemingly nowhere in the womb of a person, and I mean they start from nothing, from not even existing, and become a complete human being that has thoughts and significance and creates things. I mean, man, what a complex thing this we live in, this universe. And says, well, there must be something that made this, someone who made this. I mean, I have a spear here because I made it. Or someone made it. This spear didn't just grow out of the ground this way with this head on it and all that stuff. I mean, it's designed. And if it's designed, all this that I see gives far more evidence of being designed. Okay, now I'm a savage. I've reached this conclusion. There must be a designer somewhere out there. I don't know what he's like. I don't know how many of them there are out there. But this didn't come about by nothing. What's the next thing I would do if I'm a reasonable person? First of all, I will assign significance to this discovery. I mean, is it not significant, the question of whether there's a designer or not? Whether I exist for a reason or for no reason? I mean, once you've got the concept of design, you've got the concept of purpose, because designers don't design things except for a purpose. The person who invented the computer or the television or the radio or the wheel or fire, whatever, you know, people don't make things or come up with things for nothing. They do it for something. There's a purpose. If there is design, there is purpose. And once I've decided there's a designer, I cannot avoid the conclusion there must also be purpose. And that purpose is the designer's purpose. That means I was made for something, and the designer made me for that something, and there's a possibility that I could fulfill that design or not. I might find, if I knew more about this creator, I might find out what purpose I exist for. And if I don't find out who this creator is, I may never know what purpose I exist for. And I'm only going to exist for a short time. What a tragedy if I never find out what I was here for. And it may even be a greater tragedy than I know, because the creator may be upset with me for not fitting into the purpose that he made me for. There may be hell to pay for this. There may be consequences. There may be a day of reckoning. This design, I mean, if I make a spear and it doesn't fit the purpose because it's curved, you know, I'll burn it. You know, I don't want it anymore. It doesn't fit the purpose. And maybe when God made me, whoever this God is out there, when he made me, maybe he had a purpose for me. I mean, he must have. Why would he do it otherwise? And if I don't know what that purpose is, there's a good chance I may make him angry by doing something different than what he made me to do. I mean, isn't this the way any contemplative person who's 8 years old would think, if they didn't know anyways? I mean, I say 8 years old because I think children who are 7, 8, 9, 10 years old are the most contemplative and philosophical of all human beings, having raised 5 to that age and beyond, and having been there myself. I mean, how often do you sit around thinking of, what if I hadn't been me? What if I'd been that tree right there? What would I think? How would I feel? What if the cells and the atoms that are in my body, instead of being in my body, they were in that rock there? Who would I be then? You know what I mean? Do you sit around thinking about that? Probably not. 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds do. I mean, they're philosophical, man. They sit around and they contemplate things. And it doesn't take some genius to become responsible for knowing that there's a God out there. And that if there's a God, there must be morality. Because morality, we may not give it that term, but basically what morality is fitting into God's design. You know, God designed for a purpose. If you do it, that's right. If you don't do what he purposed, it's wrong. That's morality. And a person, therefore, who has reached age 7 or 8 years old, or has gone beyond that age and is older than that, could well be expected to have concluded from nothing else but observing of nature and thinking about it, that there's a God, that there's a purpose in life, that there may well be consequences for failing to meet that purpose, and that the discovery that there is a God is a significant one worthy of pursuit. Since if there is a God, it matters more than anything else I know. To know that I to know where my hut is or to know where my donkey wandered off to or whatever is not anywhere near as significant as knowing that there's a God. Discoveries about the existence of God call for taking significant action of pursuit of further information. And I believe that everyone who is not disposed towards suppression of truth, that everybody who loves truth, I don't care if they've heard the gospel, they are going to move in the direction of pursuing after God. Now, it's possible they'll love truth up to a point, and they'll discover enough about God that they'll say, oops, I don't know if I want to know any more about this. You know, he says that it's not right for me to get drunk. It's, you know, he thinks it's not right for me to... I don't want to know any more about this God. I was curious up to a point, but I don't want to know any of this stuff. That person ceases to be a lover of truth, and they begin to suppress the truth. The Pharisees, they had a great deal of information about God, and the Jews did, and much of it they embraced. But when it came to the issue that Jesus was now to be worshipped as their Lord and their Savior, they had reasons not to want that, and they said, no more. I don't want that. I will suppress that truth. And so it is a matter of the heart with every man. Anyone who has seen nature has seen enough to be without excuse if they turn from God and don't seek after God. And they have also seen enough to know that they ought to seek after God and to be able to do so. Now, whether they'll find him without hearing the gospel is maybe a debatable point among evangelicals. But I will say this. Those who do seek after God, whether or not they've heard the gospel, are not included in what Paul says about those who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness and who don't want to know the knowledge of God. The people he's describing, it says very specifically in verse 28, they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. Well, there are people who've never heard the gospel, but that doesn't describe them. They don't like to retain God in their knowledge. There are people who never heard the gospel who spend all their time thinking about God, thinking and trying to know more about who this God is. It's hard for me to believe that God would be angry at them. Maybe he is. I'm not going to be dogmatic about this. But what I'm saying is that Paul is describing a specific disposition of hatred for truth, hatred for light, because of commitment to one's personal unrighteous agendas. They have access to the knowledge of God, but they're not interested. In fact, they are very interested in suppressing it and ignoring it and pretending it's not there. Now, it says in verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Now, I would have you note the mood of the verbs here. They knew God. They actively had knowledge of God. They were not thankful. Had they been otherwise, they would have been thankful. That's an active thing. To be thankful is active. They had the option of being thankful, but they weren't. Now, they did not choose to be thankful. But then the verbs are all passive. They became futile in their thoughts. Their hearts were darkened. It doesn't say they darkened their heart. Their hearts became darkened. They became fools, although they thought themselves wise. What we see here is that they made some initial decisions, and then things began to act upon them in a way that they were personally passive about. They didn't choose to be fools. They didn't choose to make their hearts numb. I mean, at least that's not what they perceived themselves to be choosing. All they knew is they didn't choose to be thankful. They didn't choose to respond to this God that they knew existed. They chose to suppress the truth. They chose to ignore that, to do nothing about it, it may be, or do something to oppose it. They did not expect to become fools. That's just what happened to them. Their hearts became darkened. Their minds were blinded. They became fools. Now, when this process began, having rejected God and becoming foolish, they began to create idols. It says they changed the glory of the incorruptible God to an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Now, you have to already be a fool to do that. A thinking, rational person doesn't make gods out of sticks and stones and worship them as if those sticks and stones can do something for you. Remember, Isaiah was mocking the Jews of his day who had actually lapsed into idolatry and they were making gods of stone and of wood. And he said, oh, this is an interesting thing. A man goes out in the woods, he cuts down a tree. With a third of that tree, he warms his house. He burns it as coals in his fire, and he warms his house. With another third of it, he cooks his food. And the remaining third he makes into a god and worships and says, you are my father. Save me. And Isaiah says, there is no wisdom, there's no sense in them. There's no reasoning in them. That it never occurs to them to say, a third of this I have burned for heat, a third of it I've burned to cook my food, and the third of it is going to be a god? It can't even help itself. How can I expect it to help me? Only a person has to have their mind darkened before they can even think that way. They have to be fools. And Paul says, yeah, that's what happens. Before they come to the place of making idols for themselves, they've already rejected. They've already made some decisions about what they will do with the light they have. And they did not choose to be thankful to the God and live a life showing gratitude to Him. That's not what they wanted to do with the information. So their hearts were darkened. They became fools. And once they got to that point, they were willing to believe anything, even that they could worship a stone that's shaped into the shape of a man or an animal, and that that would somehow have validity. I mean, you've got to be nuts before you can think that way. And yet, masses and masses of humanity have thought that way. You know what's interesting about this, at one level, is how Paul's description goes totally against modern evolutionary philosophy of religion. I don't know if you're aware or not, but the revolution that Darwin started in the realm of biological evolution did not stop with him. And those who picked up on his ideas developed them far more than he did and extended them to other categories. And so today, if you study in any university the history of religion, it'll be an evolutionary history. Basically, what they'll teach you is that as man evolved from lower forms of life, his cerebral capacities became more developed and more sophisticated, and he began to think in abstract terms. And he began to imagine that in addition to the world around him, and the things he could explain, there were things he couldn't explain. And he began to assign those to an unknown category that began to, as time goes, develop into a concept of a spiritual realm. You know, I mean, we don't know why the volcano went off. So maybe there's some explanation in this other realm, the spiritual, maybe the gods were angry, maybe the volcano god was angry or something. And so that man began to evolve this concept of another realm of existence. It was all imaginary. It was all part of the evolutionary process of mentality. But along with the awareness that I need to eat and sleep with my wife and have kids and do those kind of things and keep warm, there began to be this development of an idea of a supernatural and of a spiritual realm. And initially, this took a very rudimentary form. The assumption was the volcano had a spirit in it, and the tree had a spirit in it, and the rock had a spirit in it, and the grass had a spirit in it, and the animal had a spirit in it, and everything had a spirit in it. We call that religion, which still exists among what we would call primitives, tribal peoples, we call that animism. It's a belief that there is a spirit in everything. It's not pantheism exactly, which teaches that God is in everything, but rather the rock has its own spirit, the mountain has a spirit, the cloud has a spirit, everything has a spirit. Everything is at the same time physical and spiritual. And that's called animism. And then that developed eventually into there being specific gods. The god of the sea, Neptune, the god of the planets, the god of the volcano, the god of the storm or whatever. And so this idea of there being a spirit or anything eventually evolved in the idea that there are many, many, many gods. And then, as time went on, this idea that there are thousands and zillions of gods evolved in the more civilized peoples as they began to become more enlightened and so forth, to reduce the number of gods a form of religion called henotheism developed, which was that there were many gods, but each tribe had their own one god. Or every nation, there were national gods. And that the god of Moab was Chemosh, and the god of the Babylonians was Bel, and the god of the Canaanites was Baal and Molech, and the god of the Jews was Jehovah, and so forth. And all these
every nation had its own god. They were all true gods, but just one per nation. That was called henotheism. And then, of course, finally they developed this idea of monotheism. It's not just that there was one god for each nation, there's only one god over all nations. And so, according to this evolutionary theory of religion, monotheism, the belief in one god, is a late development in the development of human thinking about religion. And that the more primitive forms of religion are animism and polytheism and many gods. And that's interesting in that it is directly the opposite of what Paul says. Paul says it started with people knowing about the real God. But their rejection of the knowledge of the real God led to them making false gods, many gods, idols that look like animals and things, and attributing life and deity to them. In other words, monotheism is not a late development and a highly sophisticated form of religion, and the tribal animism and polytheism is some kind of a primitive, you know, Stone Age kind of religion. It's the opposite. Polytheism is the development, is the cultural development of peoples who've rejected their earlier monotheism. And if you want to see documentation of that, you can read the book Eternity in Their Hearts by Don Richardson. He documents case after case after case. It's amazing he could find so much evidence, but there are many, many tribal groups, primitive groups. He talks about the Incas and the Aztecs. He talks about some of the tribal peoples in the mountains of China. All over the world, he gives examples. When missionaries arrived there, they discovered that although these people were worshiping idols, they had a more ancient tradition that they still remembered. The older people still remembered that the ancestors sent down that there was really only one God. And that all these gods they were now worshiping were a bunch of demons. But they were afraid to worship the real God because they were afraid the demons would punish them. But it's interesting because anthropology, as this book demonstrates by case after case, documented cases, proves that polytheism was not the original religion. Monotheism was. And polytheism grew up as a corruption of it. And you would expect that to be true. Every person in the world, including the most primitive aborigines, or the most tribal people in darkest Africa, they came from Noah's family, if you go back far enough, and Noah's family knew about the real God. But as generations got further removed from Noah, and the tribes diversified and so forth, and they became more isolated, and they went their own way and rejected the knowledge of God, they developed these religious ideas that the anthropologists, who are evolutionary, they think they're primitive ideas. And that monotheism is a late development. It's the opposite. Monotheism was original. The first man was a monotheist. And polytheism is a corruption. That's what Paul is saying here. It's rejection of the knowledge of the real God that leads people into the foolish, imbecilic worship of stones and rocks carved into the shape of animals and called gods. Now, they changed the glory of God. They couldn't do that without having first had exposure to the glory of God. God had exposed himself to them, but he was rejected. They exchanged what they knew for what they wanted to know. These stone gods don't ever interfere with their moral lives. Verse 24 says, therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. Now, there was a... We saw that three times in this passage it says God gave them up or gave them over. And there seems to be a progressive giving over. Initially, because they chose not to believe in God and they chose to have idols, God allowed them to kind of go their way for a bit. Apparently, they weren't totally unredeemable at this point, but he did leave them to a large degree to their own devices. Paul, who wrote Romans, also said the same thing in one of his sermons in Acts chapter 14, speaking to the pagans in Lystra and trying to introduce them to the concept of the true God because they were polytheists. It says in Acts 14, verses 15 and 16, Paul said as he preached, men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you and preach to you that you should turn from these vain things, meaning idols, to the living God, who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all the things that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without a witness, in that he did good and gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. And that's the end of the sermon as recorded. But the point here is, he's rebuking them for their idolatry, saying there's a God who made everything. And although you have ignored him up to this point, and he's allowed you to, he's allowed all nations to go their own way. He's let them go. He's given them over to they want to ignore him. They can do that, but it's not as if they had no testimony. It's not as if they didn't know anything. He did not leave himself without a witness, he says. Paul is saying that even the pagans, God had given them sufficient evidence that there was a witness to his existence among them, but they rejected it, and he let them go their own way. Until now, he says, but now God's interrupting this mad dash to hell on their part to interrupt with a message from their Maker. Namely, he has sent Jesus, and you have to repent and follow him. That's what Paul is saying. Interestingly, though, he mentions that, referring to pagan history, that God had allowed them to go the way they wanted to go. He allowed all nations to go their own way, into their idolatry. But they had no excuse, because he did not leave himself without witness. He did, through his giving them harvests and rain and good deeds and so forth that God did for them, gave them sufficient reason to know that there is a good God out there other than the ones that they're worshiping. Now, so Paul in Romans 1:24 says, therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. Now this probably only refers to ordinary sexual immorality. There's worse things to come in this story, but this probably just has to do with them letting their lusts run more or less rampant, unrestrained by God's laws. They didn't restrain themselves, and God didn't restrain them. He let them do what they wanted to do, and it begins by simply doing things that are not really sexually pure. It's not treating themselves and their bodies in an honorable way. He gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies. Sexual immorality does a dishonor to your body. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, as he's talking about the Christian's relationship to sexual morality and to holiness, he says, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning with verse 3, for this is the will of God, your sanctification, which means your holiness, that you should abstain from sexual immorality. Now verse 4, that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel, meaning his body, in sanctification and honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. The Gentiles who don't know God do not possess their bodies in an honorable and holy way. They live in passion and lust, he says. But Christians, even though these were Gentile Christians who had come out of that kind of background, were told that they must learn to possess their bodies in holiness, that's what sanctification means, and also to possess their bodies in honor. It is a dishonor to your own body, to say nothing of the dishonor to God, that you engage in immoral behavior. You treat your body as if it's nothing but a piece of meat for someone else to enjoy, and that their body is nothing but a piece of meat for yours. Paul said that a person who commits fornication sins against his own body in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. In verse 18, Paul says, flee from sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Now, it's not entirely clear how he means that, and I've heard various theories. I won't go into them now. I'll just say this, that Paul indicates that sexual immorality in a distinctive way, more than most other sins, is a sin against yourself and against your own body. It's not only that, it's a sin against God also, and that is even more significant. But the fact of the matter is, you sin against your own body. You're dishonoring your own body. Now, in Romans 1:24, when God gives them up to do the unclean things they've chosen to do, what do? They dishonor their bodies among themselves. They just become sexually immoral. It's interesting, again, Paul is quite correct historically, as you read of the cultures of pagan religions. inevitably, sexual immorality was a leading part of their lifestyles. And not just one thing. It's not just one of many sins that you can find among unsaved people. It is, of course, there were other sins, but it was one of the leading dominant sins in every pagan culture. So much so that in many of the idol temples, they had priestesses who were prostitutes, so that immorality was part of the worship of their gods. The Canaanites who worshiped Moloch would burn their babies in the arms of a bronze statue, and while the baby burned, they'd have a sexual orgy in front of the statue. It's part of idolatry that eventually, with God's image being changed, with the glory of God being changed to the image of animals, hey, you become like your God, you know? Whatever you perceive God to be, you're going to be irresistibly drawn to be more like that. If you perceive a holy and glorious God, you're going to be drawn in the area of holiness. If you perceive a capricious God, I mean, like the Greeks had their gods on Mount Olympus who engaged in sexual trysts and rapes and so forth. Hey, no surprise that the Greeks involved themselves in that kind of behavior themselves. Their gods did it. If your god is an animal, a bull, or a statue of a bull, well, you're going to act like a stud. You know, you're going to act like a breeding creature. Bulls are indiscriminate. Put them with a bunch of cows and they'll have a blast. You worship a bull, you'll become like a bull. You think God's like an animal, you'll become like an animal. There are only a few species of animal that remain faithful to one partner for their whole lifetime. They're unusual in that respect. Most breeding animals, a lion, for example, a male lion, he breeds the whole pride of lionesses. That's not immoral. That's okay for animals. It's not okay for people. But when people change the glory of God and what He's really like into the image of an animal, no surprise, they begin to act like animals. And why not? In our day, people are educated that we are animals. We're simply the highest rung so far in the evolutionary development. If you watch Star Wars, you'll find that there are further rungs above humanity out there in space where people have evolved further than we have. They don't look very human anymore, but they're superior to us, supposedly. But we're just the highest ones so far. But we're still, like the ones below us, animals. We're just living in a world where the highest value system is survival of the fittest. Whoever breeds the most and leaves the most offspring wins. That's true in the animal world. And it's not too surprising that a society that's been taught that we're really just animals, that we don't have any concept of the wrongness of violence and killing and adultery or whatever. Hey, this is what animals do. Survival of the fittest, babe. Just do it. Feels good. If it's going to give you some advantage, in your opinion, in the struggle for existence, who can say it's wrong? It's not wrong for a lion. It's not wrong for a dog. Why should it be wrong for me? If there's no God, or if the gods that exist are like animals and like man, you know, a lot of people criticize Christianity and say that Christians have created a God in their own image. And Christians have created a God, you know, to fit what they want and so forth. This is the opposite of the truth. Christians, if they created their own God, would make a different God, because the God of the Christians condemns much of their behavior. If we were free to make our own God, to change the glory of the real God into whatever we preferred, we would not make the God that we worship, because we would make a God much more tolerant of our own vices than the one we have. We are not at liberty to change God. The people who have made gods in their own image are not the Christians. It's the pagans. It is they and not we who are guilty of that. Now, these people, it says in verse 25, they exchanged the truth of God for the lie. The truth they knew about God, obviously they possessed it, or else they couldn't exchange it for something else. They're the people who suppress the truth. How do they do it? By exchanging it for a lie. You can't have a vacuum in your head. Once you know the truth, the only way you can eliminate the truth is replace it with something that isn't the truth, a lie. Once you know there's a God, the only way you can get that knowledge out of your head is to exchange that for a different opinion, that there isn't a God, or that there's many gods, or there's a different kind of God. You've got to put a lie in there to fill the vacuum left by your extraction of the truth. You don't want the truth there, but you're not going to have emptiness. You're going to have something. So they exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and they worshipped and served the creature. rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Now, verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. Now, vile passions, I mean, obviously, this is something different than what he called uncleanness in the lust of their hearts in verse 24. This is another stage. There's reason to believe that this is talking about absolute perversion, because he goes on to describe what it looks like. It's not just that they became like animals in the expression of their sexual lust. They began to do things that animals don't even do. A male dog will breed as many female dogs as he can find in heat. And sometimes if they're really confused and inbred, they might even try to mount a man or a male dog or something else. But the fact of the matter is they quickly learn that that's not what's happening, and then they don't go for it anymore. They don't redefine their sex life in terms of homosexuality. The male dog that's confused and mounting another male dog or mounting a man's knee or something like that, that dog has not given up on heterosexuality. He'll mount the females too. We're talking here about such a vile perversion that a man no longer thinks like a man. He has ceased to be dominated by who he is, and he's now dominated by his lusts. And his lusts are calling all the plays, because he has not allowed God to do so. God says, okay, I'll show you what it's like when the alternative is available. If I'm not calling the plays, you've got nothing better to call them than your own desires and your own lusts. And when you give those free rein, as God does when he gives them over to it, let it have free rein. See what happens. You not only end up in unlawful sexual activity of what would be a biologically normal type, you end up in unlawful sexual activity that is so biologically abnormal that even animals don't do it. It's one thing to be reduced to the point of animal-like behavior. It's another thing to go so far as an animal would spurn that kind of behavior, wouldn't even think of it. And what's more, in our own society, not only do the people do it, but they want to redefine normalness that way. It's not even so much that they're saying, hey, I have the right to be a pervert if I want to. It's that they're saying, don't call this perverted, this is normal. This is how much their foolish hearts have been darkened. Now, when they've been given over to their vile passions, look what it says here. For even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature, and likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another. Men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of the error which was due. Now, I don't know exactly what is meant by receiving in themselves the penalty of the error which was due. The New English Bible, which is sort of a paraphrase like the Living Bible, says, the fitting wage of such perversion is what they receive. Now, whatever happened to them, whatever Paul is talking about has happened to them, is their fitting wage for their perversion. It's not all that clear what the fitting wage is he's referring to. It sounds as if he's describing they are receiving, present tense, not in the future. They're receiving this wage in themselves. I mean, he doesn't appear to be referring to the final judgment and going to hell for their sins or whatever. He seems to be talking about something that's happening inside of them. What is it? Some people think it's, you know, venereal disease, AIDS, or something like that. Of course, I don't know that there was AIDS back then. There might have been. We don't know. But because they didn't have accurate diagnoses of disease back then like we have now. But, receiving in themselves the fit wage of their perversion, some people would like to apply that to venereal disease of various sorts. And Paul might mean that. I don't know that he doesn't. He might. Others have felt it has more to do with the perversion of their personality as a whole. What they're receiving as God's judgment and wrath is the twisting of their whole personality within themselves. It's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I can't claim to know what makes a homosexual person think the way he does. I don't even know what's really going on in there. I mean, they are so far removed from anything that I can relate with in their thinking that I don't know what's going on in there. But it seems interesting to me that gay people, as they call themselves, tend to have mannerisms, speech mannerisms, and so forth, that identify them Now, I don't know whether this is something that is, it becomes second nature to them or first nature to them, or if it's something they put on so that they can identify themselves to those outside, you know, as belonging to that community. I plead ignorance. I don't know. But it seems so universal that if they are not putting it on, it seems strange that it's such a universal pattern. It's not 100% universal, but it's common enough that there's certain mannerisms and speech patterns that just personalities that seem to advertise themselves as homosexual. And again, this might be a total put on that they do so that they, you know, it's the label they wear so that people identify them as part of that community. Or it may be that there's just that change in them. You know, something going on inside them that their personality is different than it would be otherwise. I've heard Christians suggest that this receiving in themselves the penalty for the error which is due to them has to do actually with this personality change. But I'm only repeating what someone says. I don't know that this is so. All I know is that Paul indicates that there is visible consequence in their lives for the choices they've made that are so wicked. Now, I want to just comment briefly on these verses we just looked at, verses 26 and 27, with reference to what Paul refers to the natural use of a woman. It says, for even their women, verse 26, exchange the natural use for what is against nature. Now, I suppose the majority of people who read this, since the next statement talks about men lusting after men, and obviously talking about male homosexuality, the assumption is maybe that he's talking about female homosexuality here, women giving up their natural use for that which is against nature, meaning that women lapsed into lesbianism. And then as a result of that, that men lapsed into homosexuality. I can't rule out entirely that Paul might mean it that way, but I don't think that's the most likely way of understanding it. I don't know that he's referring to lesbianism here. For one thing, it isn't historically demonstrable that societies typically find their women going into lesbianism before the men go into homosexuality. In fact, I think studies would demonstrate that male homosexuality is much more common, and that you just won't find it to be a pattern, as Paul seems to indicate that it is, that in societies that go into homosexuality, it's the women who make that jump first and then the men. Because Paul does indicate that male homosexuality seems to be an upshot of what the women did. They exchanged the use of themselves, and so the men exchanged the use of the women for something else. The man's going after other men seems to be somehow connected in the society with the fact that they no longer use women in the natural way, and that's because the women gave up their own natural use first for that which is against nature. And yet, it certainly is not the case, at least I shouldn't say certainly, but it does not appear to be the case to me, that in societies that are full of homosexuality, that men went into homosexual behavior because women did that first. I don't think that's demonstrably the case. But Paul doesn't say anything about the sexual behavior of the women, really. He doesn't say that women lusted after women. He says men lusted after men. Women gave up their natural use, whatever Paul understands that to be, and chose for themselves a use for themselves that's against nature. And in response to that, men redefined their sexual activity. I'd like to suggest, at least as a possibility, and maybe in my mind a probability, that the natural use of the woman was not a reference to just as a sex object. That's not really what God made women for. They're not made for sex objects any more than men are made for sex objects. That's not what the woman is made to be used for. The woman's use is to be a mother. At least most women. There are exceptions. We've made this very clear before. Paul acknowledges some exceptions, but he calls them exceptions. That he makes it very clear in his other writings that he believes the average woman, most women, will be and should be married and have children and be mothers. And that the natural use of the woman's life, of her using her life for God, is to embrace the role that God made her for. When God made man and woman, he said, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. He made the woman to be a helper to the man, and her role is defined in many places in scriptures. As a role of motherhood and homemaker. And women in very many ancient societies forsook this natural use. They did not. I mean, abortion is not new in our generation. It's been around forever. Women, you know, in the workplace, women in the realm of government, this is not new to our time. It's just new for Western civilization, because Western civilization used to be more governed by the Bible than it is. In pagan lands, many pagan cultures were dominated by women. In the days of Paul, even the Roman culture was dominated by women. The men held the seats in the Senate, but like one of the Roman philosophers said, we men rule the country and our women rule us. And the idea of a woman giving up her role that God had given her is not something that developed in the 20th century or the modern feminist movement. This is something that has happened in pagan cultures from time immemorial. In fact, in the Garden of Eden, God predicted that the woman would tend to want to dominate her husband. He said that in Genesis 3 and verse 16. He put it through a Hebrew idiom, but that's what he was saying, apparently. Now, women, therefore, once they reject God, they reject God's plan for their life, the natural thing they were made for, which is childbearing. Anyone who looks at a woman's anatomy and seeks to deny that that body was designed for childbearing is a person who is capable of looking at a stone and saying, you're a god. I mean, if you consider the amount of space in a man's body that is devoted to his capacity to father children, and the amount of space in a woman's body that is devoted to the ability to bear, carry, nurture children, it's an incredible disparity, isn't it? I mean, a man is mostly made for other things. Most of his body is not involved in fathering children. But a huge percentage of a woman's body is designed for the childbearing and child nurturing thing. I mean, it's nature. It's natural. We're not trying to bring some kind of religious bondage on women. This is what nature itself teaches us. And women who give up this role as wives and mothers, most of them do not give up sex altogether. I mean, pagan women don't. I mean, most pagan women who don't opt for marriage or motherhood, it's not like they're living celibate lives. It's more that they're trying to be more like men and have a promiscuous life like men have historically had who are not Christians. But women have a problem with it. Men can indeed be promiscuous and more often than not get away with it because, you know, if a baby's conceived, might not be easy to prove that it's his. A woman can't get away with it as easy. She gets caught more often. And when she's caught, it's obvious that she's caught. I mean, her body does not let her be promiscuous in the sense that a man is. Now, I'm not saying it's right for men to be. It's wrong. It's sin. But the point is, in nature, men can get away with it more than women can. But women nonetheless try. And to do so, they have to do something about the problem called the womb. And they have to either adopt some means of abortion or some means of birth control, and those things have been tried from ancient times and sometimes used very dangerously. But the point I'm making is that I think Paul is saying that the role that God has made for woman as wife and mother is something that in the pagan world, once they've rejected God, they reject that role. The distinctions between men and women vanish. I could imagine if every woman in our society adopted the feminist ideals, and every woman put on men's clothes, cut their hair like men, went out and acted like men in the marketplace, that there'd be far more men turning to homosexuality even than there are. Because women would cease to have any attraction, for one thing, and whatever attraction it was would be a corrupt one. Because God has so designed us that sex is related to childbearing, and in the case of a woman, to motherhood. And it's very hard for a woman to engage in sex regularly without becoming a mother. It has to go very much against nature in most cases. Now, that being so, the attempt to divorce sexual activity from motherhood is an attempt to cheapen it and make sexual activity an end in itself. Now, see, in societies where men view their wives as mothers of their children, as the nurturers of their children, as those who are the queens of their home and their partners in raising up the next generation and so forth, the sex life has a dimension of honor attached to it. Because the sex life between a married couple like that is always potentially fruitful and hopefully so. I mean, the idea is this could produce something wonderful. This woman could become a mother. And mother is an exalted thing. That's why when someone really wants to insult you, they insult your mother, right? Because motherhood is an honorable thing. But you divorce sexual activity from motherhood and from procreation, and suddenly you've just got a woman as a sex object. And sex is not a means to an end, it's just an end in itself. And once we've decided that sex is just an end in itself, that is, sexual pleasure is an end in itself, hey, anything goes. If sex is not intended for reproduction, then what's wrong with sex between males and each other? Or with an animal, for that matter. Someone maybe gets off on that kind of thing. Who can say it's wrong? Now, if I would say that homosexuality or bestiality are wrong, you would all say, yes, that's true. We're evangelical. We're Christian. We believe that's wrong. If I said, why is it wrong? You'd probably say, because the Bible says so, right? But then what if I said, why does the Bible say so? Well, you'd probably be able to go one step further and say, well, because the Bible's Word of God and God thinks so. Okay, but there's one step further to go. Why does God think so? God doesn't give arbitrary commands. Why does God disapprove of homosexuality? Why does God disapprove of rampant fornication without commitment to marriage? Why does God disapprove of bestiality? If God made sex for the sake of pleasure and only for pleasure, then why would he object if some people happen to find it more pleasurable to have sex with someone of their own gender? Or with an animal or with 100 different women? Why would God object if sex, after all, was made for pleasure? Some guys just don't get enough pleasure without doing that. Obviously, God had something else in mind for sex besides just pleasure. There's nothing wrong with the pleasure in the right context, but there's more to it than that. Sex was made for reproduction. And God doesn't want a man reproducing with a whole lot of women. He wants babies born in a family. That's why he's made sex confined to marriage. Homosexual sex and bestial sex and other perversions like that, they divorce the concept of sex for pleasure with the concept of sex for reproduction. You can't reproduce with an animal or with another man. And for that reason, when motherhood is rejected by the womankind, suddenly sex is reinterpreted by the whole society. Well, you know, sex is just for fun anyway. I mean, women still want to have sex even if they don't have babies. And men are quite happy to oblige them in most cases. Especially if the woman will take all the responsibility for making sure she doesn't have the babies. But the thing is here, a society where women have rejected motherhood or where motherhood is no longer held in honor no longer has any reason to hold sex in honor. Having sex is just like having a meal. Not just a meal, it's more like having dessert. Doesn't nourish anything, doesn't really help anything, it's just for pleasure. And when a society has done that, what's to prevent men from saying, well, I'm getting tired of this heterosexual sex. I wonder what it would be like to do something really kinky, you know? I mean, because sex is no longer thought of in terms of we're going to raise up another generation here. This partner of mine is not just an object for my pleasure. This person is a partner in parenthood. That's what God intended sex to be. But when man rejects God and rejects God's pattern for sex and lets them go, just let it go to its natural result, and the woman says, well, hey, this motherhood is inhibiting my sexual pleasure. I can be as promiscuous as a man. Right, let's divorce it from motherhood. Let's use birth control. Let's abort the fetus. Let's do everything we can to have sex without babies. The man eventually says, hey, sure, fine with me. Matter of fact, a lot of pagan men would love to think of sex as having nothing to do with babies. But once you get there, there's no arguments anymore against homosexual behavior or any other kinky thing that men think might be pleasurable. As soon as the concept of sex for reproduction is out of the picture, you have no further arguments against any kind of sex that may happen to bring someone pleasure. And so the society just goes down the tubes. It starts with feminism. It ends up with perversion. It doesn't necessarily mean that the feminists become lesbians. Some of them do. But even if they don't, if they reject motherhood, suddenly sex is redefined as simply for the pleasure of the participants. And once that's the truth, there simply can be no reason imagined why not to have that pleasure with any participant you want. Children, even. We live in a culture that has been shot through with feminism for nearly 100 years, close to it. And we are only living now to see the consequences of that. Pedophilia, homosexuality. Listen, bestiality isn't far behind. I'll guarantee you that. We don't hear any advocates saying we should redefine marriage to include a man marrying his horse. They're not saying that yet. But just wait. One thing at a time. There's nothing to prevent it in a society that has rejected God's pattern. And that's the direction these societies go. And then he says, finally, in verse 28, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things that are not fitting, gives a long list of those horrible things, and says they know they're wrong, but they do them anyway, and take pleasure in those who do them. I'll have more to say about this chapter next time, and then we'll move on to chapter 2. We'll have to stop there, because our time is running.